Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Hi, this is Lucy Nalpathanchil, and I'm here with Katie Tolarski, Senior Director of Storytelling for Connecticut Public. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Lucy. We're here to talk about a new hour of programming that will replace our Wednesday weekly news roundtable.
Starting January 13th, when you download this podcast, you'll still hear a focus on politics, but we're changing it up. Instead of a roundtable discussion with reporters and analysts, we're inviting elected officials from around our state to answer my questions and yours.
And Lucy, that's been something you've been doing on Where We Live since the pandemic began, like your monthly check-ins with the governor. But who else will listeners hear each week?
Well, I definitely want to continue talking to the governor regularly, but also to municipal leaders like mayors and selectmen. And of course, we'll continue to talk to leaders at the state capitol and from members of Connecticut's congressional delegation.
Will reporters and analysts also be part of the show?
Yep, you'll still hear some familiar voices to give us that analysis. There are a lot of great reporters who cover policymakers both here in Connecticut and in Washington, and I want to lean on them to give us more context around the issues politicians are talking about.
So if you're a news junkie, you can still get the latest in politics right here each week.
Or you can subscribe to Where We Live on your favorite podcast app to get this episode and others focused on Connecticut, live conversations delivered right to you. Do you have a suggestion of who I should interview? Email us, wherewelive@ctpublic.org. The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're having a little difficulty playing that clip that we wanted to air, but let's just jump right in. We wanted to talk about some voices in the news, including New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, who raised questions about lawmakers who got vaccinated early for COVID-19. Also, Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont has spoken about how he hasn't gotten the vaccine yet, but people are asking about when. And Connecticut Education Commissioner Dr. Miguel Cardona, he spoke with Where We Live earlier this year and also last year about his education plans and also why he thinks kids should still be in school during the pandemic. Dr. Cardona is in the news, as we know, because President-elect Joe Biden has nominated him for education secretary. We're going to talk about that all coming up here on The Wheelhouse. On the panel today, Russell Blair, content editor at The Hartford Courant. Russell, thanks for being on.
Great to be here, Lucy.
Also with us on Zoom, Charles Venator Santiago, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Connecticut. Hi, Charles.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut. Hi, Colin.
Hello, Lucy, Charles, and Russell.
And you can join us, too, on Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. So as I mentioned, Education Commissioner Dr. Miguel Cardona is Joe Biden's pick to become the country's next education secretary. He grew up in Meriden. He was a teacher and then a principal in the Meriden Public Schools, also assistant superintendent there. And then he was appointed by Governor Lamont to lead the state education department. It was just last year in 2019. Cardona's nomination must still be approved by the U.S. Senate. And in a statement, President-elect Biden said Cardona will help address systemic inequities and a mental health crisis in the education system, while also giving educators a raise, easing the burden of college debt, and securing universal pre-K. So I'll start with you, Russell. Were you surprised by this pick?
Well, I think, when we first saw his name surface about a week ago or so, the Washington Post had reported that Dr. Cardona was one of two finalists that the Biden transition team was really looking at. And then the governor's office confirmed that he was being vetted for that position. You know, it was kind of a surprise, I think, to some people in Connecticut that heard this. But when you step back and you kind of look at what Biden has said his priorities are, and then you look at Cardona, I think it does kind of line up quite nicely. Certainly, You know, Biden has said he wants somebody with public education experience in the job, and that's kind of Miguel Cardona to a T. He's a product of public schools. He was a public school teacher in an elementary school in Meriden. He moved on to becoming a principal. He was an administrator. So he has those public school credentials. And then another thing that Biden has made a strong thing that he wants to advocate for is reopening schools for in-person learning. He said in his first 100 days, he wants to see the majority of schools reopen for in-person learning. And when you look across the country, you know, Connecticut is one of the states that has had the most success in doing that. So I think, you know, we were a little surprised here, you know, when the name popped up. But when you step back and you look and you see, okay, this is someone who embraces public schools, and that's something Biden said will be very important to him. And then also, this is somebody who has pushed to try to resume as much in-person learning as possible in the pandemic. You know, those two things line up, and it kind of makes sense why somebody like Dr. Cardona would be an attractive pick for the Biden team.
Charles, what was your reaction? Something Russell said about how Dr. Cardona has really pushed to have in-person learning, if possible, in our towns and cities. That has gotten some pushback from local teachers.
Well, first of all, I'm always surprised when a Puerto Rican is nominated for a national office. I was surprised with Sonia Sotomayor because I usually think about the constituents. So you usually, I mean, presidents nominate people to get symbolic support from constituents. And Puerto Ricans just don't account for that many votes at a national and Latino national voting. So which usually leads me to believe that this is a very competent person that can implement, as Russell put, all the Biden sort of agenda. I think they're going to Biden's going to need somebody who can jump in and implement projects right away, because Republicans are sabotaging a lot of the initiatives or a lot of the transition that will that Biden has to sort of assume in order to get the country running. So in that sense, I think Cardona fits perfectly. I don't know him, but based on what I've read, I think he's a great candidate to implement what Biden has proposed for the next 100 days.
Now, Charles, you don't know him, but have you heard different perspectives from other people in Connecticut, including teachers?
I've heard teachers complain, and I understand. They don't want to be in an unsafe environments with little resources or with limited resources. At the same time, friends and colleagues have spoken very highly of him, saying he's a very competent an intelligent person who's going to bring a lot to the position. But again, this is sort of behind the scenes commentary. So I hear great things about him. I've never met him. But I do. I also want to highlight that national teachers associations have also been very supportive of his nomination. So while Connecticut teachers may not be happy with him, at a national level, there seems to be a lot more support.
Colin, seems like Dr. Cardona will have his work cut out from him when we think about the legacy of Betsy DeVos.
Well, yes, he has very small shoes to fill. and I mean, so just to back up this, the more that I've thought about this, the more I keep coming back to a phrase from 2010 when Biden brought President Obama out into the East Room to sign the health care reform package. And he jubilantly embraced his president and said, thinking he could not be heard, "This is a big effing deal," except he didn't say effing. and I think this is a big effing deal, frankly. I think, first of all, it's big in the way that Charles just said. I mean, it's a very powerful message of inclusiveness, and not just for the sake of inclusiveness either. This is a person who, kind of like Johanna Hayes, also has been in the trenches. You know, this isn't somebody who's been writing papers for think tanks and learning a lot of jargon at conferences. This is somebody, as you said, Lucy, who's been a principal for 10 years and then moved into the central office. And I think also, at the end of all this, you know, 6 months from now, God willing, I mean, we're in a very serious situation right now, but 6 months from now, God willing, we'll go back to talking about the other real systemic problems in American education. And for my money, that's poverty. Poverty, poverty. Those are the top three problems. That's what interferes with people's ability to learn. Poverty exacerbated the problems of distance learning and digital learning during this crisis. Both racial and economic barriers were made even more stark and clear here in Connecticut, thanks to the Dalio family. everybody got laptops, but that's not how you totally fix that problem. And you can't have done the kind of work that Cardona has done in Connecticut and not have a very keen appreciation of the role that poverty plays in terms of interfering with people's ability to learn. Because education is in our Constitution, our state Constitution, we've had these landmark lawsuits like Horton versus Meskel and Chef versus O'Neill. They still don't fix the problem, because the problem is it's hard to learn when you're poor. It's like extra hard. He wrote the big legislative report in 2014, Cardona did, on the achievement gap in Connecticut. So that's where I expect to see him ultimately make his mark. The you know, getting the schools open again, that's a 6-month problem, maybe a 9-month problem. But, you know, in 4 years, I expect to see him really focus on that. As far as DeVos goes, she told her staff recently to treat all incoming Biden appointees to act as a resistance to Biden appointees, based on what my understanding of career Department of Education employees think about Betsy DeVos. I think Biden appointees will be, you know, treated like the liberating armies of Europe in 1944. I don't think you're going to see all that much resistance. And, you know, whether Cardona is good at running an agency that has thousands and thousands of employees, nobody knows that. But I do think that this is a big effing deal.
Charles, what do you think, and Russell, about what Colin shared about the systemic issues that someone like Dr. Miguel Cardona will have to focus on? Charles?
I agree completely. And that's one of the main problems that I've seen with opening schools, that a lot of people need schools to be open in order to work or to have an opportunity to survive. So in that sense, as Colin pointed out, the Connecticut experience is a great model for the nation. If you look at the successes, I'm living through the COVID quarantine process right now. My son was in a classroom where somebody was tested positive. And, you know, I got to say that school system that he's in responded in a great way, and the state responded in a great way. I mean, we're fortunate not to be dealing with COVID, but it was scary. And I was really excited that I'm in a state that is able to respond in positive ways.
Russell.
Yeah, I think Colin hit the nail on the head there, that, you know, the longer term issue that Cardona is going to be tasked with, you know, addressing is the achievement gap. And, you know, unfortunately, in Connecticut, we're one of the places where that's the widest. But, you know, one thing I think, going back to sort of his background, and a powerful part of his story is, you know, he has said, and I think this was at either his legislative hearing or there was a commencement address he gave at Central Connecticut not too long ago, that he entered kindergarten and he did not know how to speak English. He entered kindergarten only knowing Spanish. And, you know, he really credits public schools for getting him to where he is. So I think that, you know, he intimately knows the challenges of Black and Latino children. He intimately knows the challenges that the achievement gap faces. So I think that, you know, as Colin pointed out, I mean, he authored an entire report, you know, on this. It was part of a task force at the legislature. So I think that certainly he knows those longer term, you know, issues and the things that are driving that, and has that firsthand experience. And, you know, to the point about, you know, some of the teachers that were upset with the school reopenings, you know, the education unions in Connecticut yesterday were praising the pick. And I think, to Colin's point about Betsy DeVos, I think there's a lot of people that wanted to see an educator in that position. And even if they disagree with some of the things about the reopening, you know, they would rather have somebody who has that classroom experience, you know, was an administrator, understands what the teachers are going through. And, you know, this is somebody who, as the education commissioner, still really has his finger on the pulse of K-12 schools. You know, this is not somebody who has, you know, been so removed from the classroom that they kind of no longer have an idea of what's going on. So I think that makes the pick attractive, even if people maybe aren't necessarily too happy with everything that went into the reopening plan.
So great opportunity for Dr. Miguel Cardona. But Russell, who's going to take over here for the State Department of Public of Education?
That remains to be seen. You know, we do know that last year when Dr. Cardona was picked, there were, you know, I think a handful of finalists. There was a little bit of a public unveiling of the curtain of how that pick was chosen. There was James Thompson, who was the former Bloomfield superintendent, was initially offered the job, and there was a dispute about salary and some other things. So we certainly know there were other people in the mix a year ago. You know, does that mean that those same people would be in the mix, you know, this time to replace Dr. Cardona? We don't know. You know, certainly we've seen with a lot of departments in the state, you know, you may take somebody who is there, you know, in a high up position and shift them into that commissioner's role. I mean, I think one thing that is important is to have some continuity because, you know, we're still in the midst of this, you know, reopening of schools and remote learning. And so I would think the last thing you want to do, while certainly it's great to have Dr. Cardona going to Washington, you want to make sure that, you know, you have a strong leader in place here in Connecticut and you're still focusing on all the things that that he was doing, that he was championing. And even though he's gone, there isn't a disruption to that.
Let's talk about some other people with Connecticut ties that are heading to the President-elect Biden administration. Gina McCarthy, people will remember her as the former commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Environmental Protection back in 2004 through 9. She then went on to be the EPA administrator under Barack Obama, and now she's expected to become Biden's climate czar. What is a climate czar, Colin?
It's a little confusing, partly because John Kerry also was being talked about as a climate czar. It's now also, it's at least clear now that Kerry's role will be to the outside world. In other words, he will be kind of a climate ambassador and part of the international accords that we need to get back involved in. And McCarthy's role will be here. It's actually not a new thing. It's a position that has been empty for almost a decade. Obama had appointed Carol Browner, who was a former EPA administrator, just like McCarthy, to that role between 2009 and 2011. It was called energy coordinator, but people did call it a czar. Then the Congress defunded the position. And, you know, this is going to be the problem for McCarthy or anybody. Look, Biden has said correctly that he wants to use every tool available to address climate change, and he wants really good people in those jobs. I mean, McCarthy is just, at this point, such a proven commodity. I mean, you won't find a lot of McCarthy detractors, except among those people who want to actively despoil the environment or impede our efforts to do anything about climate change. The question is, you know, how much cooperation can she get from the Senate in particular? And that'll be the thing to watch. You know, how many of these things can be done at the executive level and how many things do need laws to be passed? The other thing I would say is, you know, she's currently president and CEO of the NRDC, which is, you know, I don't know, I'm hard pressed to think of an agency in the nonprofit sector that's more effective and more pronounced in its desire to do something really, really significant about this problem.
That's the NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. When we think about Russell, I mentioned that she was the EPA administrator under Obama. She'll definitely have a lot of challenges with the Congress, depending on what happens with the U.S. Senate, as Colin mentioned, but also the perfect person to tackle all the rollbacks under Trump.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, one thing that will see that might be interesting in the first sort of phase of the Biden administration is how much of what is done is going to be kind of undoing the things, you know, that Trump did. You know, there's a lot of, you know, the environmental regulations, you know, I think is an area where there's a lot of things that can be done by executive order. There's things that, you know, government agencies can change without needing congressional approval. So that was an area where, you know, certainly throughout the Trump administration, we saw a lot of changes there. We saw a lot of states, including Connecticut, with Attorney General William Tong filing lawsuits over that. So, you know, pardon the pun, but, you know, part of it is I think she's going to be cleaning up the mess, so to speak, of kind of what was left behind. So I think it'll be interesting to see when we get beyond just sort of undoing or changing the things that Trump did, you know, what are the real initiatives and further changes that the Biden administration tries to make in the area of the environment and climate change.
Before we move on, Russell, I'd like to ask about this Waterbury native that the Currents, Michael Hamad, reported on, Brenda Mallory. She's also going to be working with environmental policy under the Biden administration. Can you talk about her?
Yeah, so Brenda Mallory is going to be the chair of the Council on Environmental Quality, which is works out of the executive office of the president. It is just another White House agency that works on energy policy, climate policy. And, you know, again, she's somebody who has a career track record in doing this. She worked when President Barack Obama was in the White House for the Council on Environmental Quality. She spent 15 years at the EPA before that. So, again, you know, this is somebody with Connecticut ties, but also somebody who has a career track record in doing this. Also, she would be the first African-American woman to hold that post, too. You know, it will be interesting to see, you know, we're seeing a number of Connecticut people pop up here in the Biden administration. And, you know, I don't think we're necessarily done with that. There could be other people with ties to the state that land in some of these positions, too.
And Russell, you know, I think it's also important to note who these people are, the people that we're talking about. I mean, it's pretty obvious. But, you know, when Biden got in, I think a lot of us just kind of chasing the old paradigms. We're thinking, well, is Chris Murphy going to be Secretary of State? Is Chris Dodd going to get something? Is Chris Chase? A lot of people named Chris who are also white guys. You know, what are these people going to get? And you know, that's not who's getting appointed right now. Instead, I mean, just to reach outside for Connecticut for a second, I mean, I'm still reeling in a very good way from the appointment of Deb Haaland to Secretary of Interior, you know, an actual Native American, a member of Congress. These are incredible choices. They're really important choices. They're not just symbolic either. They're choices of substance. I mean, we might as well also mention Marcella Nunez Smith of Yale School of Medicine. I don't know exactly where she winds up, but she's one of the three co-chairs of Biden's COVID transition team. You know, the choices that he is making are not, you know, the kind of default obvious choices of people we know and have gotten used to. He's reaching around and finding the talent where it really is.
Again, we're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. Let's talk about COVID and the fact that vaccines are in our state. Connecticut's two senators have also gotten their COVID-19 shots. Governor Ned Lamont says he'll hold off for a while. Charles, I wanted to start with you. Is this a good thing that elected officials are getting the shots now? Some are saying this builds public confidence in this vaccine, or should they be waiting behind other essential workers?
You know, I'm in favor of senators getting the vaccine ahead of time just because the Senate's going to be instrumental in the transition. And who knows what's going to happen with the Georgia elections. So the Democrats will need to have every vote count in, as part of a continuity of government. At the same time, I also respect Ilhan Omar's decision and a few other representatives' decision to say, listen, why don't we prioritize public health workers and first responders before... But I think that should be a choice. But I do believe that the Senate is going to be a crucial element. Democrats in the Senate are going to be crucial to the Biden transition. And we need intelligent government. So we're going to need all the support that we can.
Russell, what's your take?
So I have a little bit of a different perspective on that. You know, certainly I think, you know, there is some truth to having leaders get the vaccine to prove its efficiency. People shouldn't be worried. You know, we saw Vice President Mike Pence get the vaccine. We saw President-elect Joe Biden get the vaccine. But I also think when it starts to trickle down to representatives and senators, two things, you know, one, you have the danger of this getting politicized. You know, if you look at, you know, this maybe isn't the best place to look for commentary, but you look at some of the Twitter comments to Dick Blumenthal and Chris Murphy getting their COVID vaccines. And you know, you have people that don't believe this is a big deal, or it kind of further drives home the point that, you know, this is something that the Democrats are concerned about, but not the Republicans. You know, there have been some Republicans in Congress I've seen who are saying, I'm refusing to get the vaccine and we shouldn't be doing that. So it, you know, risks devolving into, again, kind of a partisan thing. Is this going to be the Democratic senators get the vaccine, but the Republican senators don't? And does that have ramifications? I also think, you know, there is a little bit of an optics problem. And I know the New Hampshire governor, you know, pointed this out. Certainly, there are enough doses available, and there are doses that have been allocated to Congress. So this is not that they're taking vaccines away from nursing home patients or something like that. But I think also, you know, this is a monumental task that the CDC and state advisory panels are trying to come up with to find a priority of how do we decide who gets the vaccine first. You know, and I think there is something to be said for, you know, there are still people in Connecticut nursing homes waiting to get vaccinated. And then, you know, they turn on the news and they see, you know, maybe younger, healthier people in Congress getting the vaccine, you know, under the guise of I'm doing this to instill public confidence. You know, I think there is some truth to that, but I don't think you need, you know, all 100 senators getting vaccinated on TV to prove to the public that this is a good thing that they should be doing. I think there is some risk that it could further sort of divide the country along partisan lines if it becomes something where, you know, Republicans are saying no and Democrats are saying yes.
Although, Russell, I want to land my piece on a slightly different square here and just point out a different thing, which is that there are a lot of people who skew Democrat who started to distrust this process, right? They don't trust Donald Trump for nothing with nothing anyway. And then he's got a program called Operation Warp Speed, which is like this whole Star Trek-y thing. Let's get it done as fast as we can. Then they see him muscling the FDA unsuccessfully to try to get it approved even faster. And so those people are, you know, in kind of the opposite camp from the one you were describing, Russell. And those people need to be reassured by figures whom they trust that it's safe. So they really do maybe need to see somebody like Chris Murphy or Dick Blumenthal, people that, you know, I mean, if you live here in Connecticut, you know them, you know who they are. You have a sense anyway who they are. And they are not obviously Trump apparatchiks. So I think there is some value in all that. You know, senators are very powerful people. They don't have to get the vaccine. So if they want to, if they're willing to, if they'll do it as a public gesture, it may help instill confidence in some of the people who do skew left of center and have reasons to distrust the process by which the vaccine was brought to market.
We got some good news with this federal coronavirus relief bill being approved by Congress. It'll extend, give resources to states, but also extend a federal eviction moratorium until the end of next month. It'll provide more than $200 million to help struggling Connecticut residents pay the rent, unless the president derails this whole legislative package, as he's hinted that he would do, I think, last night. Now, the state of Connecticut also extended its eviction ban until February 9th. Charles, this is an issue that you've been focusing on and paying attention to. What do we know about how the pandemic has really affected people, their ability to stay in their homes?
So I've been walking a lot the streets and different projects, and I've seen multi-generational families grow. Children going with the parents and grandparents taking care of the kids in small homes. So I'm hoping this will start addressing some of that and also addressing subpar housing. My concern is that just extending the moratorium will not be enough, because if people can't pay right now, they're not going to be able to pay in January or February. So the rental assistance program is going to be really useful and needed. And I'm also concerned that the next Congress provides some sort of relief. And I understand also to landlords, but also to renters, to cover what they haven't been able to pay. And there is some relief here in Connecticut, but I'm not sure it's enough.
Mm. Russell, what's your take on the downstream effects of if more people are being evicted, but, you know, landlords are still struggling to keep up their property, how that impacts municipalities, too, with their tax revenue?
Yeah, certainly. You know, that's something that I think cities and towns are concerned about. You know, for the renters, the moratorium is very helpful. We certainly don't want to be evicting people in the middle of a pandemic. But I think a lot of landlords, you know, maybe some people, when they think of a landlord, they think of, you know, a wealthy business owner that's got a huge apartment complex. But there are a lot of landlords that have, you know, a couple of maybe multifamily properties, and maybe this is something that they use to supplement their income. And, you know, after the eviction moratorium is eventually lifted, you know, if there isn't a, to Charles's point, if there isn't a robust rent relief program, these tenants are not going to be able to pay back all that back rent. And there could be a lot of smaller landlords who have been having to, you know, pay for upkeep on the properties, have been having to pay property taxes all along, and then they may have a lot of trouble recouping those costs. So I think that, you know, this is something, the extension of the moratorium is only sort of further pushing down the road when we're going to have this really, really critical time where I think we're going to see, you know, potentially a lot of renters losing their homes. We're going to see a lot of landlords that are struggling to recoup costs. So, you know, it's something that I think because of this moratorium and it's gotten extended, you know, it's a problem maybe that we're not super focused on right now, but this could be a real, real crisis, you know, that could have a wide ranging impact. So I think that it's something that, you know, from the renters to the landlords to the cities and towns, you know, they're keenly aware of, and hopefully there's, you know, some sort of movement there, you know, to address it.
And again, that state eviction moratorium extended through February 9th. I just want to point out, reporting from the Connecticut Mirror's Jackie Rabe Thomas, where she wrote, the state's eviction levels have already returned to about one-third what they were before the pandemic. And then lastly, before we end this segment, Colin, I know we talked about this before, but the State Department of Correction has reported just last night that a 69-year-old McDougal Walker Correctional Institution, person who was incarcerated there, died with coronavirus yesterday. He was serving a 12-year sentence. He would have been eligible for parole in April. This would be the 13th incarcerated person to die since COVID began in our state prisons. Another person who was 69 passed away from COVID. He was serving a 60-year sentence. I think this is the fifth incarcerated person in Connecticut to die this month. So when we think about how this is spiking also in our prison system, and this is the question of when people that are incarcerated should be getting the vaccine, Colin, what do we know about the process?
We don't, unless something has changed over the last 24 to 48 hours, we don't know what the process or policy is going to be. There's clearly a problem there. And, you know, those two deaths that you mentioned are part of a recent spike in deaths in the prison system. So, you know, there have been four or five of them in a pretty short period of time. So there's something going on there. 227 inmates have the virus and are showing symptoms. 204 are asymptomatic. 2,500 have contracted COVID-19 since the onset of the pandemic. It's a lot of people in the prison system. It's accompanied by staff problems and staff shortages. 274 staff members out of a workforce of 6,000 are out with either asymptomatic or symptomatic cases of COVID-19. So, yeah, they've tried early release. I think they could release even more people early than they are doing, because you'd like to let some of the steam out of the problem by getting more people out of the prisons, creating more space for social distancing. But my feeling is that they need to be moved toward the front of the vaccination line, assuming everybody's willing to go along with that. Both, I'd say, the frontline, hands-on DOC workers and the prisoners need to get vaccinated sooner rather than later. You know, this is just, it's a group of people who can't control their own destiny. They don't want to be where they are right now. They can't get out of where they are right now. And they can't get out of each other's way all that easily, too. It just seems like, you know, I mean, it's the optics are a little bit tricky. Sometimes people say, wow, that guy, he did this horrible stuff. Why is he getting the vaccine? Well, because he's in a population of people who, you know, could wind up, we could have just a lot more deaths in January, February, March.
Charles, what do you think about that when we think about how Connecticut has a responsibility to provide reasonable medical care to those that are incarcerated or also in other congregate settings? This is all coming just in the same time frame, the last couple of years especially, where there's been a lot of attention on the lack of adequate medical care that prisoners in our correctional system have gotten. There have been lawsuits and settlements, and this is something that you're concerned about, or I'm just curious your thoughts.
I used to work with juvenile delinquents in another life a long time ago, and juveniles who are incarcerated with adults. And one of the main problems that we always faced was that the prison conditions just, people are clustered. They don't have much, as Colin pointed out, there's no room to move around. And living in those conditions sometimes is worse than some of the retirement homes that we're seeing here in Connecticut that are older. So I think it's a question of whether we want to be humane towards prisoners who are serving their time, who are paying their debt back to society. They don't have a choice, and the conditions in facilities more often than not are conducive to spreading COVID. So it'll have an effect also on guards, and it'll have an effect on society, but it's a question of being humane, in my opinion, for people who are paying back their debt to society for, in some instances, crimes that they've committed that are serious and some aren't as serious. I would try to release as many as possible. Because the infrastructure of prisons is not conducive to healthy living.
You're hearing Charles Venator Santiago here on The Wheelhouse, Associate Professor of Political Science at UConn. Also, Russell Blair's here, Content Editor at The Hartford Current, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Coming up, a need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions collides with some drivers who want just cheap gas. That's just ahead. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. I wanted to tell you briefly about a change coming in the new year. On January 13th, this hour is going to sound a little bit different. You'll hear some familiar voices, but the roundtable format will be replaced by in-depth interviews with elected officials and with reporters who cover them closely. So that means you can expect to hear regular interviews with state leaders and municipal leaders, also the governor and Connecticut's congressional delegation. We're also bringing back listener calls on Wednesdays, so you can talk to elected officials too. And if there's a policymaker you want to hear on this show, you can email wherewelive at ctpublic.org. Now back to the show. On the Wheelhouse panel today, Russell Blair, content editor at the Hartford Current, Charles Venator Santiago, associate professor of political science at UConn, and Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show and a columnist at Hearst, Connecticut. Now, just this week, the Lamont administration announced it had signed a multi-state deal intended to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, but that same deal could force drivers to pay more for gasoline. So, Russell, break it down for us. How does this transportation climate initiative, as it's known, work, TCI?
So basically, this is kind of like a cap and trade, regional cap and trade plan, where the way the people that would pay the fees would be large gas and diesel fuel suppliers. And essentially, they would have to buy credits if they go over a certain amount of pollution caused by however much fuel they're distributing. So the other side of this that we've seen some concern from a lot of groups and different people is that, you know, this will mean more costs for the fuel distributors, and will they pass that along to consumers? Now, Katie Dykes, who's the head of the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, has said that, you know, this may amount to about, you know, 5 cents more per gallon when all is said and done. You know, she said that's less than typical fluctuations that you might see in the price of gasoline, and that the money would go toward investing in clean infrastructure projects and things like that, which would certainly help Connecticut because the state's transportation fund has been chronically underfunded. And this is a pact that Connecticut has joined along with District of Columbia, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. Initially, there were more states in the Northeast that were interested in this, that were considering it, but ultimately the pact that was announced this week is those three states and D.C.
Colin, what do you think about the narrative coming out of this? Some state Republicans saying this just means higher gas taxes down the line. But a lot of people in Connecticut are concerned about the environment. What is public opinion telling us?
Right. Well, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And so nobody wants to feel any pain. Look, first of all, I just want to just stipulate that I'm not Jim Cameron or somebody like this. I don't spend my life thinking about this and learning about this. And so a lot of what I say here is kind of heuristic. Look, this is a noble effort. It's worth trying. It's a little bit like COVID, though. I mean, you know, we live in a country where basically people's idea of freedom is kind of the license to do just about whatever they want, you know, which is a little bit different from what really freedom is. And their idea of freedom is not accompanied by any sense of responsibility. So they want to not worry at all about what their role is in climate change. I think because of that attitude, it's very hard to enact really meaningful climate change policy, particularly about something like emissions. You know, I think you're probably better off, as we have done, going after the car manufacturers and setting emission standards there. I mean, ultimately, you'd want a system that picks winners, that picks policies. This was a beef I had with Dan Malloy's transportation policies. They weren't really in favor of one thing. What you really want to do is build up mass transit a lot and then make gas really expensive so people don't want to use their cars anymore. But you can't make gas really expensive if you haven't given them that other alternative. And right now, what we're hearing actually is Metro North's kind of in trouble because nobody's, you know, people aren't riding it right now. I think when the dust of COVID clears, we're going to see that the existing mass transit, which wasn't any great shakes at all anyway, may be in kind of rough shape just from lack of ridership because it's dangerous right now. So, you know, I'm glad we're doing this. I think Ned kind of hokey-pokeyed it, right? I think Russell Lee put his foot in and then took his foot out at one point. Now he's put his foot back in. But fine, try it. But it's not a real policy to me. A real policy says, look, we want everybody if possible, to be in mass transit. We want you out of your cars. Gas is $5 a gallon, but here's all these other things that you can do to get around. To me, that's a real transportation-based climate change policy. This is kind of, you know, what the market will bear.
And Russell, quickly, this is something that the state legislature will be voting on?
Yeah, so it's, Lamont announced the pact, but from what I understand, you know, this is something that because they would be changing the fees and things that would be imposed on the fuel suppliers, the legislature would need to adopt this. We've already seen the Republicans, as you said, come out against this and categorize it as, you know, another gas tax. But to the point I made earlier, also something, and also this would not really kick in until I think it's 2023. So this is not a short-term solution, but Connecticut does need to do something about its transportation fund. You know, we saw the fits and starts with the toll proposals that, have all but disappeared. So to Colin's point, though, the ideal solution is not that you make gas more expensive and then promise down the line that there'll be other options for people. Mm-hmm. Ideally, it would be you would have some options for people and they could.
Well, I don't know where he went, but I agree with him. Yeah, I mean, you have to have those options up front. You can't just sort of say, hey, gas is really expensive. We're going to give you a train in a little while. Yeah.
Again, this is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. The clock is flying by. We're going to take another break. Coming up, we're going to go house hunting. This is The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public Radio. With us, Russell Blair, content editor at the Hartford Current, Charles Venator Santiago, associate professor of political science at UConn, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show. Now, if you're in the market for a house, the UConn Foundation is selling off a tasteful 6,000-square-foot home on Scarborough Street in Hartford's West End. The Current's John Lender reports amenities include an indoor fountain. That home was purchased for $660,000 back in 2013 during the administration of UConn's last president, Susan Herbst, in the hopes it would host fundraising events. They spent another $260,000 on renovations, and school officials say there's now too little financial advantage to continue paying taxes on that house and upkeep, and it hasn't been used much during the pandemic. Charles, what do you think about the turn of events on this donor home?
I think it's great. No need to engage in funding. Now, I was talking to the director of the UConn Hartford's campus, Marco Velasquez, before COVID, and the UConn campus in Hartford has grown exponentially over the past year. So and the facilities available by UConn are great. So I don't know if there's a need for this kind of spending in terms of this house. So I'm all for selling it, given the successes of the Hartford campus. And in some ways, I think it sort of paid for itself. There was a lot of funding there. A lot of the endowment grew substantially during the Herbst tenure. So I think, I'm all for selling it.
Colin, just to clarify, all the purchase and the renovations were all paid by donations, not taxpayer money or student fees or impacting student fees. But what's your take on this turn of events on this home?
Well, I agree with Charles. It's good to sell it. I didn't think it was good to buy it. Yeah, it's bought by the UConn Foundation, which is not a state agency, not part of that, which is a whole other set of problems because they're not often transparent. It's hard to FOIA them about stuff that they're doing. I hope it's the closure. It's not really, though, but I hope it's the beginning of the closing of the door on the era of the previous president, Susan Herbst. This was one of her follies and fancies. I would like to point out that in the same article that we're working off of, John Linder's article, he points out that she was, when she left her job as president in July of 2019, she was allowed to take a one-year post-presidency sabbatical at a salary of $711,000. Now her annual salary is $319,000 as a tenured professor of political science at Stanford. She has a deal, apparently, in her amended employment agreement, where she, as long as she teaches anything, one course, whatever, she has to be tied for the highest faculty salary at any UConn campus, except the Farmington Health Center, where you can make a lot of money. But this is the problem is, the UConn Foundation is a little bit of a problem, but they're basically, you know, they're trying to do good stuff, and it's, you know, privately raised donations and stuff. The problem has been the UConn Board of Directors, the Board of Trustees, who have were never able to rein in Herbst. I mean, this like the numbers I just read you are obscene for a public university that's having to raise tuition and, you know, cut some of its academic services to be extending these Mandarin perks and salaries to somebody who really isn't doing anything anymore. No, thank you.
Charles, I'll give you the last word on that.
I wish I had a higher salary.
You'd be worth every penny, Charles.
I agree that some of this spending is wasteful, especially when we see the success of the UConn Harker campus, where we don't need these sort of extravagant spending.
And Russell, I just wanted to hear your take on this. I know in John Lender's piece, he also noted that donations have actually increased this fiscal year. Endowment has grown. So good time to be selling off this home.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that they didn't, you know, say in that column was, you know, this thing was a flop or anything like that. But I think, you know, you can look at a couple of things. One, Herbst has left the university, and apparently they asked the new president, Thomas Katsoulias, for his view on this. You know, should they keep it? And he seemed to be okay with getting rid of it. And also, the foundation has a new president. The former president came from Emory University, and at the time they bought this house, he said, well, you know, at Emory University, we have these private dinners with high roller donors, and we wine and dine them, and they cut big checks. And you know, I just think things are sort of different at a public university, and maybe it's not the same type of kind of intimate candlelight dinner fundraising that goes on maybe at some of these more well-known private universities. So we have new leadership at the UConn Foundation, a new university president, and now we're seeing them get rid of this idea. And I think to Charles's point, you know, there wasn't really a new robust UConn Hartford campus. It was still in West Hartford. It was still kind of the aging old buildings at the time this happened. You know, you have now a new downtown location, and maybe that's something that, you know, you should be showing off to donors as opposed to a house in the West End.
It's time for feats of strength and airing of grievances. Charles, I'll start with you.
I wish people didn't go shopping as much. I'm seeing a lot of people on the street at a time where there's a lot of increase in COVID. So I'm not happy with a lot of public activity.
Colin.
I will add to Charles, there's a guy in Danbury at the Barnes & Noble who's gone viral, screaming at the manager and swearing and threatening the manager at Barnes & Noble, who's trying to get him very politely to wear a mask. And, you know, the other people who need to pay more attention to this, I'm sorry, Republicans. There's a viral video of the Whitestone Republican Club in New York dancing at the conga and singing to the Bee Gees' Should Be Dancing at a big Christmas party that they're having, and also, the conservative student group Turning Point USA is having two big events in Mar-a-Lago. Guess where? Again, these people are never masked. They're not masked. They're hopping around. They're having a great time. You would think that there was no pandemic. Well, guess what? There is one, and you're making it worse.
True. Russell Blair.
I'll end with a feat of strength. Please thank your postal workers and UPS drivers and FedEx drivers and Amazon drivers and just everybody out there who is delivering all the packages. You know, we've seen a huge increase in online ordering, you know, even before the pandemic, but more so during the pandemic. You know, just there's a lot of people out there working very hard to get everybody their gifts in time for the holidays. So I would just ask people to please be kind to these people that are working hard to get the things that you ordered to your house.
Good one, Russell.
And I just wanted to send my condolences to former Senator Ed Gomes' family and colleagues. He passed away this week after injuries from a car crash in Bridgeport. The Connecticut Post, Ken Dixon, he wrote a beautiful story about the late senator. It's worth a read. We'll share it on our Twitter. Dixon writes, Ed Gomes was a true champion of the people. Today's show, produced by Matt Dwyer. Our technical producer is Kat Pastor. Again, I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We'll be back next week.